about, I would estimate, early 1986, I went on a visit when I was in New York, actually living up in Westchester, New York, and there was a fellow there with his wife, and at the time, I believe one child, there might have been a second child at the time, I get confused as to when the children came along, but his name was Anthony, his wife's name was Nanette, and they had a son, Anwar, and another daughter who may have been born just as they got there, I can't remember, Natalie, and then another little girl came along later, I think right about the time we left, named Adriana. He had moved in from Venezuela, really a neat family, Hispanic, and came from a successful family, as I recall. I don't even recall exactly what the kind of work was that he was in. I don't know what his work was as his chosen line of work or profession, but I know that his family was successful, and they settled in. Everyone enjoyed them in the church. Actually, they moved into the area, then came into the church. They were not in the church in Venezuela. They came into the church, and I went over and visited them and invited them. And everyone enjoyed them. Just an outstanding family. And their son, Anwar, became our son. Rob's here. Became his, I think it's fair to say, about best friend. And they were about the same age, or within just a little bit of difference. And matter of fact, after we came to Ohio, I remember Anwar came here in about 90 or 91 to visit Rob. And just a fine kid, fine family. This morning I found out that Anthony was on flight 587. We had read a few days ago that there was an Antonio Forteza on that flight, but that I didn't know if that name was common as a Hispanic name. There are hundreds of thousands of Hispanic people in New York, but I thought New York and flying to South America, I guess the flight was going through Santo Domingo, I just wondered. And we went to a website this morning, my wife did, and they were announcing that, in fact, Anthony Forteza had been on flight 587. Now, if you're confused about that, that was the flight that crashed November 12th on just off Rockaway Beach after takeoff. The tail had broken off and nosedived. You know, I can't help but think about what those last minutes were like. Now, we've had a number of plane crashes. That one, for a while, appeared to have maybe been terrorism. In fact, I think they took off a little too close. This is the latest I've heard, a little too close to a Japanese jet or Korean jet that had flown out ahead of it and got caught in this ferocious turbulence that lasts for up to 2 minutes in the wake of these big jets. And it may have ripped the tail off. There may have been some problems with the tail. Heard that too. But all is right with the world. And all of a sudden, the plane nosedives. Your life is over. And who knows? I wonder, was Anthony sipping a cup of coffee? Was he? I can't believe he was yet. Was he just figuring out, you know, how to set his seat straight? A minute off the runway, flying over those islands there in the kind of backwater of that peninsula. If you know the area, I've driven it many, many times. I've visited brethren out there and had dinner at times right on the very street where that jet struck. I mean, it's just very real to me now that I know that somebody was on the flight. Shifting gears a little bit, as I mentioned in the announcements, I've been obviously thinking about and researching the subject of, is there life after death? I've noticed in Mr. Armstrong's booklets, now having finished number 22, I've noticed that there was a theme in almost all of his booklets. Not everyone, but it would be close. And that was the subject of the truth about the afterlife. Now, that's not what this sermon is about. This is an introduction to a sermon about a different subject. But you realize, as much as I've been kind of going through it, of course I wrote the booklet, The Truth About Hell, and some of the research that goes into those booklets gets your mind on the subject, and then it lends itself to covering certain other booklets that you may not have wanted to cover, I may not have wanted to cover in a particular order, but I did. And the next one that came up was Life After Death. It's also in my mind because in going over the subject of Unknown Until Now, or Mr. Armstrong's book, Never Before Understood, Why Humanity Cannot Solve Its Evils, and mine is a similar title, I went over some of the things that Mr. Turk covered in the sermonette. When Adam made a decision to not eat of the tree of life, certain things happened. Certain events and conditions flowed from that, and it's affected the world ever since. Original sin didn't flow from it, where flesh is inherently evil because of what two people did 6,000 years ago, but in fact, some things did flow from that. One of them is, of course, the death penalty. Another one is Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden and no longer allowed access to the tree of life because they ate of, instead, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The death penalty is appointed to all people. Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed unto all men once to die. I guess when you see someone who is so real, so vivacious, I mean, just a terrific, terrific family, all of a sudden snuffed out. And I'm sure, you know, part of it is the shock of knowing this morning what I had dismissed a few days ago as having been a real, you know, probability or possibility. Now, in fact, it's real. Life is fleeting. Life is fleeting. The world as we know it is just as fleeting. People in the world don't get along. It isn't just because of what's going on in Afghanistan that I say that. People around Kunduz today, I guess we'd have to say, if we're going to break it down to any number of different ways you can look at events in northern Afghanistan where there's a holdout of, you know, Taliban Arabs who will not surrender as others are today. I guess one way to look at it is, you know, there's some folks up there that aren't getting along. The third Daisy Cutter bomb was dropped yesterday, I believe, or maybe late Thursday, I think it was yesterday. A Daisy Cutter is a bomb that just basically mows human beings down like they were daisies in a field. That's the whole idea. Or just think of a field of daisies. Well, this is a bomb that is like a lawnmower, only it mows human beings. The idea is a lot of people are troubled by what happens if you have a surrender. You have a lot of people who can never be let out of jail. So there's this ongoing debate about, do we just kill them all, try to engineer it so that there is no surrender because there cannot be survivors, because if they're survivors, they have to be locked up forever because you could never trust them again, release them into safe havens or, you know, other countries. Once you've rebuilt Afghanistan, they simply operate on this these perverted ideals that they have. But the fact is, when you look at the world from its most basic perspective, it doesn't get along. I was thinking about if somebody asked you, why is there war? They would never believe James 4, verses 1 to 4. From whence come wars and fightings among you? James asked. And then it goes on in a series of verses and explains they simply come from lust. Try to tell the Joint Chiefs, try to tell a general, try to tell a buck private, try to tell anybody whose life is the military. You know, we were watching on the Macy's Day Parade and watching news on Thanksgiving, and here are various soldiers saying, here's what I'm thankful for, and they're stationed here or stationed in Bosnia or there in Afghanistan or on a ship somewhere. They're saying hi to their parents back home, saying what they're thankful for. They are out, in their mind, making the world safe for democracy. That's what I was taught wars were about, that there were unjust wars and there were just wars. Just make sure if you're going to go to war that you're in a just war. If you're going to drop a daisy cutter and mow human beings down like grass, make sure you got a good reason. Don't mow them like daisies if it's a bad reason. And of course, then you come down to just human reasoning. What's a good reason and a bad reason? The long and the short of it is the world doesn't get along. Now, recently, I've talked about democracy because of, again, going through the writing of the booklet, Should Christians Vote? Ultimately, democracy, democratic government, is people governing themselves. If you really want to think about democracy in one way, you know, Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others, and that's true. Among men's governments, we'd rather be here than any other, but democracy's got a lot of problems. But ultimately, if you just break democracy down to what it is, you know what it is? It's people governing themselves. Now, cut off from God, people can't govern themselves, and democracies don't work. But if you stop and look at your own life as a Christian, you're supposed to be governing yourself. That's what democracy is supposed to be. Government of, by, and for the people. In principle, it sounds great. It just doesn't work unless you look at individuals governing themselves. Then, in a sense, by a certain definition, democracy, I guess we'd say, is right. Christians are people who are supposed to govern themselves. Now, that's not all there is to government in the church. There's more than that to government in the church, and this is not a sermon about government. Turn to Genesis chapter 4. I've covered this subject from time to time through the years. I think 5 or 6 years ago I gave a sermon on it, but most of you would not have been there. So I want to go through this subject again in a different way. I guess I'm sobered. Ecclesiastes 9:10 says, "What your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there's no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor anything once you go to the grave. Once your life is over, your opportunity to grow, to overcome, to develop, to solve individual problems in your life, to learn to manage and govern yourself is over. Your record is written. It's done." I'm sure, as I was saying earlier, none of the people in those towers or in the Pentagon or on those planes or a million other circumstances that happened since that time where people suddenly were snuffed out, did they think the grave was so close? I've often said, the best part about being dead is once it happens, you don't know you're dead because the dead know not anything. There is life after death, of course, but the dead know not anything. David said, when a man dies, in that very day his thoughts perish. The Psalm says that. Now, once life's over, there isn't anything you can do about anything anymore in your life, and me either. So while you're here, you have to address certain very real issues that confront you, whether you wanted them to or not. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1, "And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have gotten a man," it should be, comma, "the Lord." She called her son the Lord, not a man from the Lord. One of the problems with Cain is his mother called him the Lord. "And she again bore his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, of the fat thereof," I mean a really good quality, proper offering, "and the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering." So that's a better offering. You know, I don't know, did Cain bring a bunch of dandelions or a few herbs or something from his garden? I don't know, but Abel brought a proper offering and the best of his sheep. "But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect." Now, Cain didn't stop and say, you know, I've done something wrong here. The God who made the sun, moon, and stars is unhappy with me. The problem is probably me. That isn't what he did. That isn't what carnal-minded people do. I mean, you would think, humanly, if you have upset God, and God is standing right here talking to you 6 feet away and says, I'm upset with what you did, chances are you would think that you would say, I would say, I'm all ears. Is there anything you need to tell me? I'm listening. You have my full attention because you made the entire universe, and you're God, and I'm not. So what's on your mind, or however you'd say it? No, Cain got angry. It's got to be somebody else's fault, is what he said. And his countenance fell. He got, I guess, a long face, the first long face in history. When I showed a long face growing up, I was told, I don't like long faces. My parents didn't. We had to have short faces. And my mother said, short faces are better than long faces. Well, Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, if you do the right thing, shall you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door. Now, so far he hadn't sinned. He didn't give a very good offering, but not necessarily sin, as far as I can see. And unto you shall be his desire, and you shall rule over him. And Cain talked unto Abel his brother. And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. Mr. Armstrong said something 35 years ago I'd never heard anybody ever say before, and it took me a long time to understand the purity of his statement. I guess next month, if I get into the booklet on human nature, which I think I will, I'm going to have to go into the big four of human nature that Mr. Armstrong talked about over and over again. He said human nature is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. Well, that just seemed too raw. I mean, I thought, all right, that's Mr. Armstrong. I'm learning doctrines. I didn't dismiss it. It's just I never fully understood it until I dealt with thousands of people. And you just sort of see it's true. He was jealous. And he killed him. Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel, your brother? And he said, I know not. Well, that's a lie. But then comes this question, am I my brother's keeper? A lot of people ask the question, well-known question, I'm not my brother's keeper. And they sort of cite the Bible. But you know, that's not what the Bible says. The Bible asks a question. Cain asked a question. It's recorded in the Bible. So you could say Cain asked the question. And it's a question. It's not a statement. Am I my brother's keeper? If you read the context, it really doesn't directly answer it. It's a sort of rhetorical question that's supposed to be an obvious yes. And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries unto me from the ground. And now are you cursed from the earth, which has opened her mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. Now, Abel was a servant of God. There are other verses that call him righteous Abel. Chances are religion was at the core of this. This is probably the first servant of God who was ever persecuted to the point of being murdered. There are other verses we could put together far from Genesis 4 that would show that, but that's not the subject of the sermon. The point is, Cain was his brother's keeper. He'd done a poor job. Fundamental question, are you your brother's keeper? I don't just mean your physical brother, they were physical brothers. Are you, am I, are we each other's keepers? People say, I'm not your keeper. Ever heard that term? Who are you? You're not my keeper. The truth is, that's wrong. The truth is, you are, and others are your keeper. You are others, and others are your keeper. Now, there's lots of rules that govern that, maybe a few rules that govern that, but the fact is, let's just establish something. Cain was his brother's keeper, and he did a very poor job. He lost his brother. He wound up getting sent away with a mark on him. Also, we are, in fact, our brother and sister's keeper. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17. Let's introduce some concepts. There are certain things about the way God works. Now, in a court case, a lot of legal decisions are made because one person witnesses against one other person. A woman says, "This man raped me." Now, there was nobody else there. She says it happened. Unless he wants to do 25 years, generally you'll find he pleads innocent. All right. The fact is, you have one witness one way and one witness another. Now today we have forensic evidence and all kinds of things can be introduced into a case that can add some things that were not available several thousand years ago. But consider this verse in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 6. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses, now that's an interesting statement, it says two or three, shall he that is worthy of death be put to death. But at the mouth of one witness, he shall not be put to death. Do you know, here's what's interesting. If someone confesses to a crime, do you know by law, that attorneys tell me this, that prosecutors tell me this, this is a fact. If you go out and rob a bank, and then confess, and there's absolutely not a shred of evidence of any other kind from any other source that you did it, they cannot convict you. You can beg the prosecutor and the police to convict you. But if you cannot prove you did it, if they cannot find some corroborative proof that you did it, you're off. It's happened. It's happened with murders. The rules of evidence and bringing a conviction involves some corroborative evidence, even when you have a confession. The reason is there are people who are messed up enough that they'll confess to things they didn't do. There has to be some other corroboration that it's a legitimate confession. It isn't though they'll sit there and say, we don't believe that it's a legitimate confession. There is the chance that it might not be. A lot of people take credit for a lot of things they didn't do. Now, most of the time, it's the other way around, and so we don't think of that. We think of people doing stuff, and they say, "I didn't really do it. I'm really a victim. I know you think I'm a perpetrator, but let me tell you, I'm a victim. Somebody else is the perpetrator." Going through this article on should Christians submit to government authority, made me think about how many times I've been in jails and lockups and prisons as a guest, talking to people and asking them, what are you here for? Well, you've just got to understand, Mr. Pat, I know these other people, they're guilty, but I'm not. I've received several letters just since Restored from people in prisons in this country, several, telling me that they're innocent and they need my help. Some cases I knew how they found out about me, and other cases I didn't. I've seen it many times through the years. And sometimes there are those who will say they're guilty, but they're looking for a minister to validate them as a born-again Christian so that they can go before a parole board with the appearance of being a more changed person. That's just a fact. I've seen it many times. Been involved in it many times, known of it many times. Rarely do people say, "Yeah, I did it." But the fact is there are people who say they did it and didn't do it, and that's the point we're talking about for a moment. So a person can't even be put to death in this country or convicted on their confession, one witness, even if the witness is themselves. Now, I suppose if somebody said in the Old Testament, "I did it," that's one witness, and somebody else says, "Yeah, I saw him, he did it, or she did it," then you'd have two witnesses. But the presumption is you get two or three witnesses because none of them are the perpetrator. God's principle is you need several witnesses before you can establish things. Chapter 19. Turn over a couple pages. Chapter 19 and verse 15. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin in any sin that he sins. Now, that's pretty plain. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. Now, there it is again, two or three. That's not the last time we will see two or three. It's not the last time. The fact is, in all probability, the only way to explain that, because I've never seen a particular verse where you have two or three witnesses explained, here's why it could be two or three. The presumption pretty much has to be, if it's still a little cloudy after two, then go to a third one. Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 1. Leviticus 5 and verse 1. And if a soul sin and hear the voice of swearing, Leviticus 5:1, and is a witness, whether he has seen or known of it, if he does not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. Now, if you witness somebody else breaking the third commandment, that would be the voice of swearing, and you are party to it, you know it happened, you're supposed to speak up. Now, that was a responsibility. It was a law. You hear about something, you have to speak up. So it couldn't be that, you know, a mob action occurs, you know, soon after I got to New York City in about 5 or 6 weeks, as I recall, maybe, I'll see, no, I guess it was maybe about 2 months after I got to New York City. About one block down the street from where we were having Sabbath services, the guy that John Gotti replaced got wiped out during Sabbath services a block away at Sparks Steakhouse. I might have mentioned this one time. His name was Big Paul Castellano. He was about 6 feet 8 inches tall. He's even taller than I was. And, you know, he and his driver were killed as they were going into this famous steakhouse one block from Sabbath services. Big Paul Castellano. It's amazing how when the mob does that, there were no witnesses. Nobody saw anything. There's lots of people who witness things, but when you come back and talk with them later, they can't remember anything. Well, I don't remember. I was in the back of my house. People don't like to be involved. You know, the famous Kitty Genovese story of this girl who was, raped and murdered, and it was happening during Gunsmoke back in the 60s. It happened many times since, and worse situation, but the famous case in New York City, and her screaming was disturbing a lot of people who had their windows open on a hot summer night, and they couldn't, it was just bothering them. They couldn't hear the dialogue on Gunsmoke. So a lot of people got up and shut their windows in New York so they could concentrate, didn't have to listen to this murder and rape going on down below. But that's human beings. The many, many examples of people who witnessed things but didn't want to get involved. It's none of my business. Philippians chapter 2. Now let's go to the New Testament for a moment. Philippians chapter 2. Verse 3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Now you've seen this verse many times, heard it explained. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. You're supposed to look on other people's things. Now since the 10th commandment condemns covetousness, this is obviously not a verse that says if you drive a Ford Pinto, they still have Pintos, and your neighbor drives a Rolls Royce, look on his Rolls Royce and covet it. That's not what it's talking. If you live in a $100,000 house and your neighbor lives in a $500,000 house, spend time studying his house and wishing it was yours. That's not what it's talking about. It's be concerned about other people's things. Things doesn't have to be their car, their house. It's their life, their interests. Most people are concerned about their own interests. Look not every man on his own thing. Now, what do most people concern themselves with? Their own stuff. You know, hey, look, that's none of my business. What goes on in this neighborhood, what goes on in this company, you know, that's none of my business. I'm just I'm focusing on what's my own stuff. There are times, obviously, to do that. If you don't know what you're talking about, you're not involved and don't have the facts, by all means, don't get involved with strife that doesn't belong to you, because there's proverbs that say if you do that, you're grabbing a mad dog by the ears. Meddle not with strife that doesn't belong to you. You grab a mad dog by the ears, and the reason is you don't do it is because you can't let go. That dog will turn and grab you. You've got hold, and you better just keep on holding on. When you get involved in strife that doesn't belong to you, you're going to get in trouble. There are limits to the verse. Otherwise, we can be busybodies, nosy, and unwise, and there's a lot of verses. But I'm trying to establish something here as we move along. You look on the things of others within proper limitations. Philippians 1:9, just look back a page and we'll read one verse that shows there are some limitations, so you understand, just right here on the same page. Paul said to the same Philippian church, and I pray, and this I pray, that your love may abound yet more and more in knowledge and in all judgment. I mean, that's in knowledge and in all good sense is what the Greek means. In knowledge and in all good sense. Show good sense. Have a lot of love for people, but you know, if your concern is not tempered with wisdom, you can stick your nose in where it doesn't belong to you. And so I just want to establish before we go on, God did not give people carte blanche to involve themselves in the lives of other people without any restrictions or any restraints. We are each other's keeper, so just have at each other's life, because you'll have a Gordian knot of human relations mess on your hands if that happens. And yet we found if you see certain things happening, you cannot keep quiet about it. You're supposed to look on the things of others. So obviously there is a place in the center of those principles, those extremes. There's a principle in the middle that applies to Christians. We've seen it Old Testament and New. Now, let's suppose you see someone having a problem. When do you go to a minister? When do you go to a minister? Let's just ask the question. People wrestle with, Mr. Pack, I'm just aware of this. Down through the years, I've seen this many, many times. Mr. Pack, I'm aware of something. I just don't know what to do. And people wrestle with when to come to a minister. Now, as I've explained, if somebody is trying to split the church in some way, sowing division or discord, trying to divide the church, they can be doing it through false doctrine. They can be trying to just split people. There are human beings who are just flat out divisive people. God hates it. When it's that kind of a problem, the church is threatened, you go to the minister. Short of that, you don't go to the minister. Yes, if somebody is involved in a huge sin, you should. If you know somebody is cheating on his wife and they're not going to be in the kingdom of God, yes, you should come to the minister. But you probably ought to go to the person and say, look, you need to go get help. You're not going to be in the kingdom of God. I love you. You're my brother or sister in Christ. And you know what? You're cheating on your husband or wife. You have got to say something. Now, are you going to go or am I going to go? So it's a different kind of situation. They're not trying to split the church. What they're doing may be about to split their family, but it's a very different situation. It's important we understand this, brethren. But you know, there are an awful lot of times when problems need to be addressed in the church and the minister is never to be involved. I've sort of cleared the deck on when he is. There's only about two situations. One is a deep sin that's going to keep a person out of the kingdom of God. Then you're sending the person. And if you see they're going to destroy themselves, they haven't offended you. They're doing something that is clearly wrong. They took a job quietly on the Sabbath because they can't make ends meet or whatever. You see, then you have to get involved on their behalf. But then send them to the minister. That's always the best way to do it. And if they don't go in about a week or so, then you have to go. Or if they're trying to split the church, then you don't wait at all. You just don't wait at all. You owe them nothing. They're trying to hurt the church. And you're part of the body of Christ. And if they're trying to hurt the toe, and you're the hand, or they're trying to hurt the eyeball and you're the ear, you know what 1 Corinthians 12 says? You've got to say something. That said, we've cleared the deck. Now we're going to talk about how you handle certain problems. Matthew 18 and verse 15. Matthew 18, 15. We've set the stage. Let's move into a number of verses now. We're not going to have a lot of ministers in the restored Church of God. One of the reasons I'm giving this sermon is because there aren't going to be a lot of ministers to go to. We'll have enough. We'll have enough to feed the flock of God. We'll have more ministers coming along. Probably more will come with us as time goes on. More will develop from among us, elders and so forth. But the fact is, we're not going to have a lot of ministers. The ministers are not here to do certain things that God intends brethren do in their own lives. Matthew 18 and verse 15. Moreover, if your brother shall trespass against you, different situation. They've done something to you. Go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Now look, what they're doing to you, let me just be sure that this is clear, is trying to get you to keep Tuesday as the Sabbath. Or you understand what I'm saying? Telling you it's, I really think we're born again in this life. I've been studying the issue, or I really think this or that doctrine is wrong. Okay, they're doing that to you, and you can say they were offending me, so I tried to work with them. No, that's not the same. That is not the same. But if your brother shall trespass against you, go and tell him his fault. He does something. It hurts you. Tells a lie about you. Gossips about you. Does something significant. Go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Now that is a command of God as surely as you shall have no other gods before me. It is an absolute command of God. If he shall hear you, you've gained your brother. There's an old saying, my dad used to tell me this, my father, taught me to box when I was a little kid and told me to defend myself and how to do various things. He said, son, if you ever have a fight with another kid, you'll find out your best friends when it's over. And I found out that was true a lot of the time. I had enough fights to be able to learn that, unfortunately. And I learned that, if you have an argument, you work things out. That's not the way you do it in the church, of course, but out there in the world, there is something cleansing, I found, in a certain, you have to understand, physical way. You have an argument. Out in the world, arguments many times get physical. You can gain your brother. You realize this was dumb. You got it out of your system, and you wind up friends. It's happened to me more than once. But if he will not hear you, then take with you one or two more. Now, I thought we read two or three. Well, we did. That in the mouth of two or three, remember, the person counts as one, add one or two to one, and you've got two or three, every word may be established. That's step two. If he shall neglect to hear them, tell it unto the church. But if he neglect to hear the church, let him be unto you as a heathen man and a publican. So the fact is, that verse says, go to your brother. It does not say, you have the option of going to your brother. Now I have found down through the years, this is one of the least applied verses, commands, if you will, in the Bible. Down through the many years I've been in the ministry, I've heard all the excuses. We'll talk about some of them. And when it was applied, it was usually done almost entirely wrong. I rarely ever saw anyone employ this correctly. They either didn't want to do it, and I'll explain why in a moment, or they did it looking to cream their brother to crucify them. Or went with an entirely wrong attitude, ensuring there was no way the brother was going to receive it correctly, and it had a very predictable end. So it's go to your brother, not to the minister, not to others. You don't even go line up your witnesses, unless there's some unique circumstance, I suppose, in advance. You go to your brother. Now, there's a great potential there for self-righteousness, obviously. I am going to my brother. I'm going to sit him down, and I'm going to stand on the top of Mount Olympus with the rest of the gods and inform him about how he's still made of the flesh, I'm not. Okay, don't do that. That's not going to get anywhere, because it'll sound like you're coming from Mount Olympus and you don't have flesh, and you know, and he does, and she does, whatever. Great potential for self-righteousness. Great potential. Why won't a lot of people do it? Luke 17. Here's why a lot of people won't do it at all. Now, this is a fascinating verse. You can even have a little fun with this verse if you really think it through. Luke 17, verse 3. Take heed to yourselves. If your brother trespass against you, rebuke him. That means censure, admonish him, straightly charge him. That's pretty straight. Rebuke him, censure him. You know, if you do certain things in the Senate, they'll censor you. If you do certain worse things, they'll kick you out. Or they'll, I guess there's three or four or five different disciplinary actions the Senate or the House uses with people who violate ethics rules or different things, sometimes criminal laws and so forth. But it also means forbid him, you know, rebuke him, censure, admonish, forbid, straightly charge him. And if he repent, forgive him. And if he trespass against you seven times in a day, now I don't know if any of you, I've never had a single person ever trespass against me seven times in a day. I don't know if I've ever had anybody trespass against me seven times in my life. I mean, I suppose I could theorize you could too. Maybe that's happened. And seven times in a day turn again to you saying, I repent, you shall forgive him. So we've just about covered any possibility of worst case scenario. You know, the Pharisees would say, okay, what do I do on the eighth? But you understand, we pretty much covered all the possibilities. But here's the interesting response on behalf of what Christ said to the disciples. And the apostles said unto the Lord, increase our faith. That's a remarkable response. Increase our faith. Wait a minute. You're telling us to go rebuke somebody, censure, admonish, forbid, straightly charge them. Now, most people won't do that. They're afraid they won't be liked. They'll not see it working out for some reason. They just envision all the reasons why it's not their responsibility. Maybe I'm really not so sure of my facts after all. They were sure enough. I've seen many, many people sit in my living room just sure enough of their facts to tell me about them. But when it came time to tell the person, now they weren't suddenly so sure because they thought maybe I would handle it. The reality is that's not what God says to do. And I've been sucked into at times early in my ministry going and handling a situation where I was not allowed by God to yet be involved. And every minister who's honest will tell you it's happened many times. You get confused. Oh, wait a minute. All right, is this a situation where I should be there? No, this is just two people knocking heads, and I'm not supposed to be involved. Maybe I would at step three after witnesses, but shouldn't be involved. Because if a right attitude is exhibited, people can work out their problems. Generally, most of the time, they can work them out. People who have the Spirit of God can work them out. Keep your hand there for a moment and turn back to Matthew 18. Just keep your hand there. Go back to Matthew 18 and let's just read on for a moment. Here's where you have faith. Verse 18, we stopped at 17. Verily I say unto you, whatsoever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. If you have to make a decision, somebody won't repent, put them out. And whatsoever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you that if two of you shall agree on earth as touching anything, it shall be done for them of my Father which is in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. Now, this is a profound verse that has been horribly pulled out of context by a lot of people who hate the government of God. This is actually a statement about how the government of God works when the church has to make a decision. A lot of people today, this is kind of a sidelight, take this verse and say, we don't have to go to any church. We can do anything. We can stay home wherever two or three are gathered together. As long as we say we're doing it in Christ's name, He's here with us. We don't need ministers. The fact is, this verse is in the context of sitting down with brothers, sitting down with sisters, and helping them. And when you're doing that, Christ is there with you. That's what it's saying. If you have the faith, no wonder they said, Lord, increase our faith. It takes faith to believe you can go to another person, because if you go to somebody who's not converted and you talk to them like they're a brother, look, they can turn later and trash you. They can get mad. They can swing at you. They can do whatever they're going to do. If they're not converted, it takes faith. And of course, remember, Christ said, if you have to do it seven times a day, you rebuke them seven times. You have the faith to do it. In effect, He didn't say that, but they knew exactly what it takes to believe that that'll work out. They said, increase our faith. But the reality is, Christ is there, and it takes faith to believe that. When you are sitting down in a humble attitude with somebody who has offended you, go through the issue with them. Remember, if you are the people, if we are the people, if all of us are collectively are the people of brotherly love, true Philadelphians, we care about other people. We don't want to nail anybody. You don't want to crucify them. You don't want to let them off the hook, because if they'll offend you and we don't love them enough to tell them, they'll do it to somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. Everybody will say, well, they'll just have to learn on their own. That's not what God says. Now, obviously, if somebody is offended, they need to examine, should I be offended? I've had people get offended down through the years. When I've walked into services, I have my mind on my sermon. I've walked into congregations where there were 500-600 people, actually over 600 at one congregation before it split into two. And I have my mind on my sermon. I'm tall. I've looked past certain people, didn't say hi to them, or I sort of shook a couple hands in a circle and missed one. And I've had people come to me 1, 2, 3 years later, having not forgotten that I didn't shake their hand when they were in that circle. And I think, oh, now, by that definition, an offense is ridiculous. But you'd be surprised. You know, I walk into a room, basically all I see is cowlicks. You know, I'm tall. I don't always see everybody. Sometimes I'm thinking about what I'm doing. And so I know that there are people who can get offended by what others do to them. And there wasn't really an offense there. Some people are offenses waiting to happen. They're just ping-ponging through life, walking around just waiting to detonate. They're a human landmine, so to speak. And I know that some get offended at what others say to them because of what I hear sometimes offends them that I say to them more than others do. I hear it come back, and I'm not talking about here at headquarters. I'm just talking generally in life. But it takes faith. Most won't step out in faith and say, you know, Christ said He's with me. This is going to work out. I love my brother. We're going to resolve this for their good and mine. And if you go in the right attitude, you'll actually learn as much as the person who was the recipient of what you pointed out. Ephesians 4 and verse 26 says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Don't let the sun. You get angry, resolve it. Resolve it. Don't be afraid of offending other people. You're not going to say it perfectly. Let me just say something. If you're afraid that you won't handle the matter perfectly, let me relax you. You're right. You won't. And there's no one right way to handle it. For every two people that have even the same problem between them, they can live halfway around the world from one another, and two people in one part of the world have the exact same problem, two people in another part of the world have the same problem, it'll be handled a little bit differently. If you're worried about handling it wrong, don't worry, you will. I'm saying that to relax you. I often have said that, you know, when I performing weddings, talking to couples and, you know, counseling them. They're just worried that everything isn't going to go perfectly, that, oh boy, will the music just start right on time, and will the ushers have everybody seated right, and let's see, there's two special music, will that be just at the right time, will the pillows be in the right place, and will everything go perfectly? And you can tell when you're counseling a couple, and it's cute, they're all that way, you can tell they're worried about us. You know how I relax them? I say, you know what, you're worried about things going wrong, aren't you? Yes, you're right, something's going to go wrong. Then all of a sudden they relax. They realize perfection isn't the goal. Then have a wonderful day on your wedding. I said, forget it. This is your wedding day. Enjoy it. If you trip coming down the aisle and break your nose, get up and finish, you know. I was performing a wedding one time. This happened. The true story. My wife was there. Here was a fella standing. Here was this girl. This has nothing to do with the sermon. It's just a story I want to tell. And he was standing right there beside her, and I noticed him a little woozy. And he was going like this, weaving. For those who can't see this, this isn't a video. I'm up here weaving. I'm going back and forth. All right. And I saw him. He blanched. And I was the only one who could see him, literally the only one. Everybody else was behind him. His bride-to-be was right beside him, but she was focusing on me, and I'm the only one that sees we're about to have a wipeout. And this guy was about to let go, and he sort of reached out to take this towel from his brother. His brother handed him a towel, and he blotted his face a little bit, and he handed it back, and he fainted straight backwards and went directly into convulsions. Convulsions. His bride was standing 4 feet away, shrieking. It's the most incredible scene I've ever seen. What happened was his brothers had kept him up all night. He hadn't eaten anything. He'd had a little wine, and it was a Sunday morning wedding. He'd had a little wine, and he very cocky guy, by the way. And I'm sitting here thinking, if this was ever going to happen, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody, this might be the fella that maybe needs it, just might. But anyway, he's literally in convulsions, it was not a pretty scene. Well, he finally woke up. All right, didn't end there. We had to stop the wedding. Took him outside, was in a house, took him outside, gave him some orange juice, get his blood sugar up. And every time, I mean, I was funny. It was Ted, two brothers, and they were walking him around the backyard, one on each arm. He was just so faint. It was I have these amazing memories, and I'm waiting. He comes. I said, "You ready to go?" I mean, an hour passed. This guy was full of orange juice. And he couldn't find the energy. Each time he started to go back in, he started to feel faint again. And, the bride is sitting in there, and, you know, people are comforting her. And finally reached a point, he just simply couldn't go on. So I had him come in. I said, enough. Sit down. So this absolutely elaborate wedding, they both had to sit there because he couldn't stand up. And I was not above razzing him later, I will tell you that, but it was the only way to go on. Now look, if they were looking for perfection, they didn't get it, but I'm going to tell you, they're married today. Nothing in life is perfect unless it's done by God. You're going to make mistakes, whether it's a wedding or going to your brother. It's just life. It's just life. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 7. Verse 1, judge not that you be not judged. One of the reasons people don't go to their brother or sister is because, I'm not their judge. No, I'm not their keeper. Well, I'm not their judge. Well, don't be their judge. It means don't condemn them. Condemn not that you be not condemned. Don't condemn them to the lake of fire. It's God's job to decide who goes into the lake of fire and who doesn't. For what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. Now that verse, unfortunately, and I think I gave a sermon on this one time, that verse has become anything anybody does, no matter how absolutely horrible it is, if you point it out to them, you're judging me. You're judging me. No, you're not. If a man walks in on his wife or a wife walks in on her husband, believe me, in the ministry I've had this happen, and they're committing adultery and they catch them in the act and they say it, I've actually had the mate caught in the act turn and say, you're judging me. So people can say it under almost any circumstance you can imagine. People commit a horrible sin and you say, you know, that's wrong what you did. You're judging me. They tell a lie or they gossip or they do something, you know, terribly wrong. Don't condemn them. But on the other hand, don't ignore the fact that you have a right to point something out. Luke chapter 6. Verse 37. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. Condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Now, sometimes you don't even have an opinion. Depending upon the Greek word, judge can mean several. You don't even have an opinion if you don't have the facts. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together and running over, shall men give unto your bosom. And so forth. Now, verse 39, he spoke a parable unto them. Can the blind lead the blind? Shall they not both fall into the ditch? The disciple is not above his master, but everyone that is perfect shall be as his master. And why behold you the mote that is in your brother's eye, but perceive not the beam that is in your own eye? Either how can you say to your brother, brother, let me pull out the mote that is in your eye, when you yourself behold not the beam? Now, a mote is a little kind of a toothpick, or a little, even more like a speck. When you yourself behold not the beam, you know what a beam is, a great big beam of wood that is in your own eye. You hypocrite, cast out first the beam out of your own eye, and then you shall see clearly to pull out the mote that is in your brother's eye. Now consider what it's saying. Consider what it is saying. It's not saying, cast the beam out of your eye and leave it at that. It's saying, then pull the mote. First remove the beam. Then pull the mote from your brother's eye. You still have a responsibility. You still have that responsibility, Matthew chapter 5. You know, human beings make mistakes, brethren. We all make mistakes. I'm glad most people don't know about my worst mistakes. And you can be glad most people don't know about your worst mistakes. Maybe somebody knows about some of mine and somebody knows about some of yours. But you know, in the church of God, when mistakes are made, and we all understand that we're on the way to the kingdom of God, we all are going to goof. We're going to mess up. Sin means to miss the mark. We miss the mark. You know what? We help each other. This is God's way of having people who are supposed to love people help the people that they love. This isn't about how God's legal system works in the church. Yes, there can be a point at which you reach a stage where somebody is involved in something and it's really serious. You know, they're a thief. They're just stealing over and over again. You have to deal with them. But that is not usually the case. Most people, anybody who is converted, will eventually appreciate being helped out. Now, Matthew 5:21. You've heard it said by them of old time, you shall not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. In other words, somebody who is utterly unworthy of God's help. That's what fool means. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and remember that your brother has aught against you, leave therefore your gift before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Now, I'm reading this verse because many times Brethren, we'll look at Matthew 18:15. And if your brother offend against you, go tell him. If your brother has aught against you, that means you offended him, you're supposed to go to him. You say, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't the brother have come? If the brother has aught against you, you've offended the brother. Matthew 18:15 says it was supposed to have already been resolved. The truth is, there are people who will offend others, and the people they offend will not come to them. So God has a fail-safe system. It's supposed to go the other way around. That way, there's no way an offense can remain between two people. There's no way. If you are either the offended party, the offendee, or the offender, if you default, either way, the other one is supposed to pick up the ball to make sure there's no possible way that offense can remain. Do you see that? If your brother trespassed against you, go to him. Matthew 5 presumes your brother has trespassed against you, and it was never resolved. He's got aught against you. I mean, you had trespassed against your brother, and he didn't come to you. It was never resolved. Well, maybe your brother is weak. You have to go, so the problem is resolved. I think I said it backwards. You understand what I meant there the last time I went through it. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. Galatians 6 and verse 1. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you which are, and it should be, walking in the Spirit, same phrase as verse 16, this I say then, walk in the Spirit, you'll not fulfill the lust of the flesh. You which are walking in the Spirit, anybody who's converted, and that's what it means. It doesn't just, well, if you're spiritual, well, I'm not very spiritual. Somebody else is more spiritual. They're spiritual. I'm not very spiritual. I'm a little spiritual. It's really, and somebody, you misunderstand the verse. It's sort of like somebody has to sort of stop and say, you know, I am really a spiritual person. I'm allowed to fulfill, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. No. It means anybody who's converted, anybody who's walking in the Spirit is a spiritual person in that sense. We think of spiritual people as somebody who really deeply converted. Well, there are people who are more deeply converted than others, obviously, but this means anybody who's converted, who's walking in the Spirit, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. I've seen people go into situations where they're trying to help other people, and they get sucked into the problem. They find out the problem wasn't just between others, and sometimes when you go to somebody, be ready. They may put some smoke up. They may confuse the issue and try to say, this is more complicated and there's others involved, and you get sucked in to something that is now bigger because you're involved rather than the resolution of the problem that you wanted to be instrumental in resolving. Or maybe they have some idea in mind, some false doctrine they're teaching. You don't necessarily know where they're going, and you go on in and you're ready to tell them something, and they start spewing out some false doctrine, and you didn't consider yourself. You didn't gear up and gird up the loins of your mind, and you go on in and you get sucked in. I've seen an awful lot of brethren sit down through the years to help other people get out of doctrinal problems, and they're pulled in themselves. I've seen it many, many times. How important is this? Bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. The law of Christ is you go to your brother. You go to your sister. It's the law of God. The Ten Commandments are not the only laws of God. James 5 and verse 19. Now, some of these scriptures I covered in a sermon about, do you proselyte? Do you talk to others? Do you try to help others who are overtaken in a fault? Yes, you can. You bring the minister in, but let me tell you, if you know and love somebody and they're involved in a false doctrine, you are also allowed to be involved in trying to help them. I want that absolutely clear. You have to involve the the ministry because they may be trying to split the church, but that doesn't preclude you remaining involved. Look, brethren, James 5:19, if any of you do err from the truth, it's obvious, that's talking about a doctrinal matter, and one convert him, let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. Well, if somebody is about to go into the lake of fire because they have started to pull away, and all of a sudden sins are starting to pile up on their ledger in God's sight, a multitude of them, that's going to take them out of the kingdom and into the lake of fire and death, then you can save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins. And the whole context is erring from the truth. I think one of the most troubling things that I ever saw in the last decade, of all the things I saw in the last decade, one of the most troubling departures from the doctrines of God, and most people don't even think of it as a doctrine of God, is that when wholesale, vast numbers of people began to sell out doctrinally, there weren't a lot of people who tried to stay and fight the good fight and help them. A lot of people says, not my business, you know. I watched people. Scores of thousands of people grabbed a knife, let me just be as graphic as I can, reached up and slit their own throat doctrinally, and a lot of other people said, my hand wasn't on the knife. They did it to themselves. Well, yes, they did. But a lot of people erred from the truth, and a lot of other people stood by and did nothing about it. Could any of them have been saved? Yes. Could all of them have been saved? Almost certainly not. Of course not. Many were never converted. They were nothing more than filler in the church, called to be co-workers perhaps, while this great ministry, the fulfillment of Mr. Armstrong's ministry and prophecy, what he was and who he was, took place. And 250 million people heard the truth as a result. The fact is, a lot were never going to be converted, but there are some who probably could have been saved. I have no doubt of that. I had a nickel for every time I sat down with people who were about to leave the Worldwide Church of God, and I asked them, please, try to help other people. Most of them said, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to get out. I said, well, let me tell you, and I saw it happen so many times. The second phase was, oh, I wish I'd stayed for a week or two and tried to help others, that I used to then tell other people, oh, look, I've had many people leave and say they were sorry. They didn't stay a little while for a week or two and try to help other people. You're going to be sorry. There are going to be people who are going to wonder, what happened? You just disappeared. Boom, gone. And they're going to even think maybe you fell away if you don't tell them where you're going. Well, I don't want to go back. I don't want to say anything. And they didn't, and they were often sorry. So I would tell them, there are many who are sorry. They're sorry. They wish now they'd done it. Just think it through. And so that's what happened. Okay. Ezekiel 3. You know, one of the reasons the Ezekiel warning exists is because it is a doctrine. That we do it. It exists here. We are doing it is because it is a doctrine. It's not just a commission. It's a responsibility that is generally a thing done by God's servants. Ezekiel 3:18, when I say unto the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him warning, and you give him not warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. Okay, very straightforward verse. You warn the person, God says, you're off the hook. You know what chapter 33, 7 to 9 says. You don't warn them, you're not off the hook. The core of Ezekiel's warning is that people have a right, and there is a responsibility for them to be warned and for us to do it. That's exactly what Matthew 18 is about. That's exactly what Matthew 18 is about. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. I've often said you can provoke people in the wrong way. That the very verse prior to Galatians 6:1 talks about some are provoked to wrath. You can provoke people the wrong way, but you can provoke people unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully, after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins. I'm going to have an article in one of the upcoming pillars about the importance of assembling together. Those verses, 23 to 26, makes it very clear that a lot is at stake when people stop doing it. And there are many, many, many hundreds and I suppose thousands who have forsaken the assembling of themselves together. They just don't believe they have to do it. One of the reasons is there's nobody out there provoking them to do it. Not provoking them to anger, but provoking them to assemble. I know that there are some who would be with us if they knew we existed. You'd be amazed how many people say, Mr. Peck, I didn't know the Restored Church of God existed. We're now 2 years and almost 7 months old, and they don't know about us. A great many don't know about us. Who would be with us? Don't go out in the highways and byways and recruit them, but let people know. Let people know if they're erring from the truth, if they're not assembling together, and they're just slowly dying. You know, you may be able to help them. Exhortation is our responsibility when it comes to assembling together in the end time. That's what it says. So much the more as you see the day approaching. And that could be also the Sabbath day. You exhort people. But that's not generally what it means. It doesn't mean about Wednesday or Thursday, and certainly by Friday you have to exhort people to be there Saturday. That's not talking about the Sabbath day. Maybe with some few that could have an application. That's talking about the day of Christ's return. The closer it gets, the greater urgency and need there is for God's people to exhort those who are not faithfully attending or who are going home and just sitting there. Go to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12. And verse 8. Verse 7 says, actually the context is verse 5. We should pick it up. So we being many are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering. For he that teaches on teaching, if God has given a gift to somebody and they're being used in that way, they don't appoint themselves, you understand. Verse 8, or he that exhorts on exhortation, he that gives, let him do it with simplicity and rules with diligence and so forth. If it is your responsibility in a certain matter to exhort, then do it. Do it. Some people are better at doing it than others. Some maybe have the ability to exhort others, to encourage, to stir others up more than others. Well, that's probably natural, and they're going to maybe do it more. Jude 3, Jude chapter 3. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and to exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. One of our responsibilities for the rest of the age is to exhort all of the people of God who still care, who still love what we all once loved, who still care about what we all once cared about, is to exhort them to earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. We also, I suppose it could be said, have to exhort them about the need to sometimes exhort one another. Exhort means to call near, to pray, to beseech, to comfort. It's a combination of things. It's different than rebuke. Sometimes a person may need to be rebuked. We saw that. Christ said that. That's different. An exhortation is different than censoring, admonishing, forbidding, or straightly charging someone. It's calling them near. It's beseeching them. It's comforting them. It's lifting them up, maybe even praying for them. If someone is telling a tale, somebody is passing on something that is wrong, don't listen to it. But if you do hear it, tell them. Say, you know, what you're saying is wrong. And stop a lot of situations that can lead to offense before they ever get out of the gate. Just stop them. Nobody can bear a tale if there are not ears willing to hear it. Amos 3 and verse 3, final verse. Amos 3 and verse 3. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Now that's sort of like the am I my brother's keeper question. The answer is not given here. The answer is not given there in Genesis 4. It's a rhetorical question because the answer is so obvious. Paul asked, is Christ divided? The next word is not no. There are many places in the Bible where it's obvious Christ and his church are not divided. So Paul didn't have to say no. It was an obvious question. Can two walk together except they be agreed? The answer is no, they can't. Now, first, of course, that is true. People cannot walk in the church of God if they do not agree with it. Mr. Armstrong talked about the scriptures are plain. We have to agree with God and Christ and his headquarters. And in the restored church of God, we're blessed with that. I don't know of anybody who holds doctrines other than what we all hold, and that's what Mr. Armstrong taught us, which, of course, was from the Bible. So I don't see that. But ultimately, if that happens, people cease to walk with the church because they're no longer in agreement. Let's just say it for exactly what it is. A lot of people no longer walk together because they cannot agree. They're split into all kinds of groups, because they can't even agree on where to disagree. If they could agree on where to disagree, as I often put it, they agree on where to disagree with Mr. Armstrong, they could agree on that much, they could at least walk together. But they all disagree with Mr. Armstrong, but don't agree on where, and so they're all split from each other. A couple that can't agree on how to spend the money are going to eventually not walk together. An employee who can't agree with his boss is eventually going to walk away. People who do not agree with God, I could even show you scriptures in the Bible where people simply don't agree with God. Cain's an example. He didn't agree with God's assessment of the matter. He didn't walk with God as Abel did. We have to agree with God, all his ways, and we have to agree with Amos 3:3. But there's a third application. It isn't just you in the church or you with God. The third application is, you cannot walk in agreement with your brother if you disagree. That's pretty obvious. Resolve disagreements in the church, brethren. If you are having problems with somebody, anybody, anywhere, at any time, resolve them. Work them out. Sit down. Reason together. God says he does that with us. If we have a little bit of God in us, if two people have a little bit of God in them, they're begotten of God, they're walking in the Spirit, they should be able to sit down and reason through situations. If they're close to God, they're doing it in meekness, they can work things out. Once in a rare, rare occasion, it will escalate to the second stage where you have to bring witnesses, but almost never does it go to the third stage. That's very rare. It's very, very rare. Let's walk together in agreement, but let's agree with God about how he says to remain in agreement with one another.